This episode of To the Journey is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help Trek.fm at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. And if you want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode, join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
I think it's safe to say that no one on this crew has been more obsessed with getting home than I have. But when I think about everything we've been through together, maybe it's not the destination that matters. Maybe it's the journey. And if that journey takes a little longer, so we can do something we all believe in, I can't think of any place I'd rather be, or any people I'd rather be with.
To the journey.
You're here.
To the journey.
Hello, everybody at home, and welcome. This is To the Journey. I'm your co-host, Suzanne Williamson, and with me, as always, is...
Zachary Frueling.
Well, today we're going to be discussing the Season 2 episode, Innocence, or as I like to call it, Uncle Tuvok Storytime Hour.
An alternative title, Suzanne, would be Tuvok Can't Find His Loot.
That would be more of a mystery episode. You would expect Scooby-Doo and the gang to show up.
Scooby-Doo. I don't know, Suzanne. I was actually thinking when we're done recording tonight, I will put on some of Tuvok's Lullaby Greatest Hits. Lull myself to sleep tonight.
Coincidentally, I did try and use that little snippet of a lullaby that you see in the episode to see if it would put Logan to sleep as quickly as it put those kids to sleep. It didn't work.
Oh, did you have to loop it?
No, he just laid in his crib and looked at me like, what is this? So Tuvok lied. He can't put kids to sleep that fast.
I'm kind of picturing an alternative version of Someone to Watch Over Me where the doctor tells Tuvok, Tuvok, you've got a lovely singing voice. Can't you picture the doctor? Tuvok, that was flawless, but put a bit more emotion into it, would you?
All you would get from Tuvok would be the raised eyebrow. That's it. That's the extent of the emotion he would put into it.
Well, Suzanne, in rewatching this episode, I was actually a little surprised. I don't think of this episode as one of the great episodes of Star Trek Voyager, not even one of the great episodes of Season 2. But as I rewatched the episode, I really enjoyed the episode, and I found so many things that we can talk about today.
Yeah, it's not a great episode for Season 2, but it is a really good Tim Russ episode, which we don't get very many of. So when you find one, you kind of grab onto the good bits of Tuvok where you can.
We get to see a kinder, gentler Tuvok.
1,000 points of light, Tuvok.
Yes. This is the 90s.
This is like some really bad inauguration speech.
Really, that's the thing that stands out about this episode to me, is we get to see Tuvok being remarkably compassionate for a Vulcan in a number of different ways. He comforts Mr. Bennett at the beginning of the episode. He's got parenting skills. He's training children to conquer their fear with Vulcan logic.
And he's getting plenty of hugs. And Tuvok needs hugs.
Tuvok always needs a hug. Yes. Don't we all, but Tuvok in particular?
Definitely Tuvok. I would give him a hug if
I
saw him.
I would hug Tuvok. I hope you would too. Sure, absolutely.
So watch out, Tim Russ. If I see you, you're getting a hug.
Well, he'll either pencil you in or he'll have his security guard there. One of the other.
I'm going to say security.
Security. Well, let's go down the list and let's decompose compassionate Tuvok, the kinder, gentler Tuvok. He's remarkably comforting to Mr. Bennett.
Who is also decomposing.
Good one. Wow. I walked right into that one, didn't I?
You did.
Right out of the gate, At the very beginning of the episode, yes. Tuvok tells Mr. Bennett that Ensign McCormick would miss him very much. And I think that's remarkably compassionate for a Vulcan to think of saying that when someone's dying versus the thousand other things he would say as a Vulcan.
Well, Bennett was saying that nobody's going to miss him. He has no family, no friends.
So was this a logical response for Tuvok to basically reply and say, well, there is one person who would miss you? Or was this an emotionally supportive response from Tuvok?
It was completely logical. Tuvok was stating, hey, there is someone that will miss you. That wasn't him being emotional at all. That was stating a fact, a logical fact.
Well, I think that's what's interesting. When you go down the list and look at all these examples of Tuvok being compassionate, they are logically compassionate at the same time. Mm-hmm. They all have a reason and a purpose, and they're Vulcan things. And there's one instance in the episode when Tuvok is talking to Tressa. He's describing not what he feels about his children, but the fact that his children are part of his identity. And Tressa basically says to him, you miss them. And, you know, yes, he does in a logical Vulcan way, but not in an emotional way. But all these examples of compassion, whether it's responding logically to Bennett's statement that no one's going to miss him, whether it's trying to calm the children down, whether it's teaching them how to meditate, all of those are logical things, but they're all very compassionate from a human standpoint as well.
Well, Tuvok also had a little bit of an emotional moment. I mean, with the slight eyebrow raise when Tressa says that Tuvok reminds her of her grandson. You could see it. His eyebrow went up just a little bit, and it was like, oh. It kind of caught him right there in the Vulcan heart. It's like, oh.
I was wondering why they didn't do a mind meld at the end of the episode.
Why would they do that?
Because Tressa has 90-some-odd years, 94 or 96 years of life experience, and Tuvok is a Vulcan, so he can mind meld. Why wouldn't he do that?
Because there's no reason to do that. You're just going around mind melding with people willy-nilly just because they're old and you want their knowledge? Is that what you're doing?
Yeah, it's like space genealogy.
Dude, boundaries.
You don't think that would be beneficial to soak up as many lifetimes of experience as possible if you could while you're a Vulcan?
No, because a mind meld is a very personal thing. You just don't do it with everybody.
I see your point. I still think, you know, the benefits outweigh the cost there.
I don't know about that. Because then you're also imparting onto the person that you're having the mind meld with, saying that you're the Vulcan, you're imparting your emotions onto them.
Sure, but Tressa's going to be dead here in a week, so.
Dude, that's messed up. She shouldn't spend the last moments of her life dealing with Tuvok's emotions.
All of a sudden, she's got to deal with Tuvok's unresolved issues for the last week of her life.
Yeah, that's messed up.
What a way to go.
Bad enough she has to go in that cave, and who knows what happens in there because they leave their clothes behind. It's like left behind. Oh, it's full-on rapture type thing. You know, the people are gone, their clothes are left just laying there. I really want to know what Tuvok's away mission log reads about going into that cave. What did he see? I want to know.
And then the rapture happened.
And how does the rapture know not to take Tuvok as well?
I know this is a serious tangent, Suzanne. Mm-hmm. I know we just dropped a Left Behind reference, but do you remember way back in the 70s, the Thief in the Night series of movies?
No, I was not alive.
They're like a proto Left Behind. Same kind of thing. Religious movies, rapture, the whole shebang.
Okay, so, I am not familiar with them, no. It's a movie you've actually seen.
They're great
seen.
Movies. Yeah, because I grew up going to church youth group and stuff. These are movies that they would show kids to scare them into being religious as teenagers in dark youth group rooms late at night. You know, yeah, totally. There's a series of them. There's four of them. And one of them, Image of the Beast, is the third one in the series, I think, has the most scary introduction of any movie I've ever seen to this day. It's because, yeah, you should watch it just for that one scene.
I'm gonna have to look this up because I love like horror movies and being scared and. Just, yeah. So I'm going to have to look that
up. You should look it
up.
You can probably find it on YouTube. You know, it's called Image of the Beast. You should look it up. Okay. Absolutely.
If it's not scary, you're going to hear about it. Let me just tell you.
Well, it's not scary. It's suspense.
Okay.
They drag out suspense in an impressive way.
Okay. I will look it up.
The whole movie is actually really, if you can get past the religiousness of it, it's actually a really good, low budget, crappy religious movie. If that makes it, I still enjoy the movie, even though it's, you know, it is what it is. I still think it's interesting.
I happen to like really low budget, crappy horror movies, so it might fit in there.
Where were we? We were talking about... What were we talking about?
We were talking about the rapture and Left Behind.
Right. Okay. Rapture and Left Behind. And I took us on a total detour. Well, Tuvok didn't go to Vulcan church enough.
Did Vulcans even have a church?
I don't know. They're not really religious per se, but they definitely have some spirituality.
They do have spirituality. They've got their
belief in immortality of Katras and all kinds of stuff, right? So it's not church. It's spiritual. He doesn't have enough faith in the immortality of the Katra. Because you got to have faith, faith, faith. Tuvok. You got to have faith, faith, faith.
Oh. I'm sorry, George Michael. I am so sorry.
George Michael is rolling over in his grave. Yes. Yes, he is.
Aww.
That rendition.
I have nothing more to say about the rapture.
I don't either.
I don't even know how we got to the rapture.
You were talking about going into the cave.
Oh, okay.
At the end. Oh, we were talking about mind melds, right? Mind melds.
Yeah, mind melds.
Why didn't Tuvok mind meld?
She had to go in the cave and yeah, okay.
You'd think, isn't that a normal part of Vulcan death? Like, you're going to die, so you mind meld, right? So if Tress is about to die, Tuvok should have mind melded with her. That's what Vulcans do.
But she's not Vulcan. She's not Vulcan. If he was going to do that, he would have done it with Mr. Bennett. Because he knew him better than he...
Do only Vulcans have Katras?
I'm guessing so.
So Vulcans can't mind meld with a non-Vulcan, and non-Vulcans have their soul, their Katra, whatever the analogy is for their race, downloaded into a Vulcan. Or uploaded, as the case may be, I guess.
I don't...
It's only for Vulcans.
Why would he impose his beliefs onto her?
It doesn't matter. It's not a matter of belief. It's a matter of whether it works.
Still, Vulcans are very private about mind melds, as well as other things. But they're not just going to go, hey, I'm going to touch your face and, you know, steal your soul.
Oh, it's a Vulcans-only club. Tress is not in the club.
Dude...
Vulcans can mind meld with non-Vulcans.
Yes, because Spock mind melded with the Horda. If you can mind meld with a rock creature, you can mind meld with anybody.
But did the Horda's Katra get uploaded into Spock?
No, because the Horda wasn't dying.
Wait, if you're not dead yet, why does your cat? What? Okay, I have to ask this question. Okay, so if you're not dead
yet,
you mind meld, how does your Katra know whether it's about to die when you haven't died yet?
I'm sorry, my mind went completely to Monty Python.
Right? Okay. So there are two kinds of mind melds. There's the I'm about to die a mind meld, mm-hmm. the Katric transfer mind meld, and then there's the I'm not about to die ordinary mind meld, which is still emotionally significant, but it is not a Katric transfer. What distinguishes the two? Is it something Vulcans have to consciously do? Like, I'm going to transfer my Katra to you right now, and it's a conscious thing. Or does that happen automatically when you're about to die for some reason I don't understand?
I am not a Vulcan master. I do not have these answers.
Because it seems like it's a special kind of mind meld.
I would think so from, you know, what happened at the end of The Wrath of Khan with Spock and McCoy. He touched his face differently right. than, you know, a regular mind meld. He was like, touching it and then remember. It was a different touch on the face.
Where you put your fingers makes a difference in a mind meld.
I think so. It's like little pressure points.
Now I want the Vulcan mind meld manual, like where you put your fingers for what effect.
When do you use your left hand? When do you use your right hand?
Yeah, I'm picturing some sort of like phrenology map of the heads of Vulcans. A Vulcan phrenology map.
Do they have practice heads, you know, in school? You can practice where you put
your fingers. Sure, you have to learn these techniques, right? Or do they practice on each other? Like
that? No, I don't think you would do that because that's very personal.
So you practice on a dummy, yes. Like CPR.
Well, I was thinking, you know how like in hairstyling school, they have the little heads kind of along the same thing. You're just not messing with the hair. You're messing with the face. I don't know. Why are you so obsessed with mind melts tonight?
Because I want to know why they didn't mind meld.
Why did they need to?
It would have been such a perfect moment.
No. It wouldn't have added to the story at all.
Yes, it would have, because all of those 96 years of Tress's experience wouldn't be lost forever when she reverse ages and dies.
They're not lost. They're not lost. Her family remembers her. Just like everybody else when they die.
Well, actually, if you remember, according to the Draenns, her energy gets released and it floats off to a new plane of existence and it isn't lost. I don't know how you reclaim the knowledge once it's floated off to that new plane, but...
But also, Tuvok stated that she will live on in his memories of her.
Well, that's true. That's a pretty non-metaphysical way of thinking about it, right? That's like, I just remember you. That's nothing... That's not like a Catra. That's just memory.
Okay. So you're really, really pushing this mind melt thing. The last mind melt Tuvok had was with Lon Suter.
And we don't want Tressa turning into Lon Suter, so.
Or even knowing anything about Lon and his crimes. So that mind melt did not end up very well for Tuvok. So why is he going to try another one?
Tressa's going to become psychotic in the last week of her life.
What if she was some kind of criminal? Tuvok could be affected by that? We don't know.
Well, if so, she doesn't remember it, right?
But it would still be in her mind somewhere. So she can't access it. Tuvok might.
Well, getting back to the different ways that Tuvok displays compassion in this episode, one of my favorite things is towards the end of the episode when he lets Tressa help him work on the shuttle so she's left less afraid. She's not worried about the monster. She's got something to do.
Now, I do have a comment about the shuttlecraft. They have not been childproofed in any way, shape, or form. They're coming out with weapons and all kinds of things, almost hurting each other. I noticed that right away. I was like, why are the kids just allowed to run around? Picking up little torches.
They don't even have those little plastic covers for the EPS power taps.
Exactly. Somebody's going to get hurt. Another note on the shuttles. Why are there two different types of shuttles in this episode?
Where do all these shuttles come from?
Did you notice that the one that Tuvok is in is the old boxy looking one, and the one that the captain and Tom are in is sleek and all?
Well, they repurposed it for the Next Generation, clearly.
Well, yeah. But why have two different types of shuttlecraft on one ship? On a brand new ship? Why would you do that?
The Enterprise D did, right?
Voyager was brand new.
So it would be all new shuttles, yes. No old shuttles. Yeah. Well, there's not just old and new. There's different classes of shuttles, right? Class 1, class 2, class 3, right? Yeah. And presumably they have different features, different purposes, reasons.
Why would one look like a tissue box and one look like a sports car?
For Tom Paris to drive. Got to have a hot rod for Tom. Tuvok gets to drive the old and busted version. Old and busted shuttlecraft and new hotness. I've never really thought that the old boxy shuttles were very aerodynamic looking. No wonder it crashed.
No. Oh, no, they looked awful.
Those things don't glide. Why are you so obsessed with shuttles tonight, Suzanne? You're just as obsessed with shuttles as I am about mind melds.
No, I'm sorry, I have not gone on for 10 minutes about shuttles. I just wanted to know why there were two okay. different types.
Touché. While we're thinking about great Tuvok moments in the episode, I love the talk to the finger moment that Tuvok gives the kids when he's trying to get them to be quiet. He basically holds out his finger to shushes them, but not like to his face, but he holds his finger out at them.
That's a total parent move. Because I do that move.
It's like, watch the finger. It's like, it's hypnotic. Like, whoa, all of a sudden you're just focused on his
finger. No, it's like, it's the finger and the eye. It's like, you know you mean business then.
Well, there's this great duality to Tuvok because he looks irritated by the kids through the episode, but he's loving every minute of it. He's actually a really good parent. I think he likes calming these kids down.
How do you know he's loving every minute of it?
He's vulcanifying them.
That doesn't mean he's loving it.
He's teaching them to meditate. He is getting them to be quiet and well-behaved. He's getting them to...
So they will annoy him less.
No, he's singing his Vulcan epic poem.
Because he didn't want to tell him about, you know, ferocious creatures.
You don't think he was having fun with it?
I don't think Tuvok has fun. He will be the first to tell you he doesn't have fun.
Yeah, he would say that, but he does have fun. And he would say that he doesn't care about his own children, but Tressa calls him out on it, and he does care about his own children.
He never said he did not care about his own children. He never said he didn't care about them.
What did he say exactly?
Vulcans just don't express emotions the way that humans do. So you're trying to humanize Tuvok when you can't because he's a Vulcan.
I guess I just see this emotional undercurrent to everything he displays in this episode.
Because you want to see it. You want to humanize Tuvok.
I'm going full on X-Files here. I want to believe. I love that he describes his own children as well-behaved. Do you actually think it would work to teach children to meditate like he does? Does that actually work? Like, he actually calms Tressa down by teaching her to meditate or attain a meditative state.
I think it's a very good idea to get children to embrace their fears and to help them conquer them.
I love that there's this physicality to it. You take your hands and you put your hands in a certain position that helps you focus. And I guess meditation is like that. It's not just a mental thing. There's a physical component to it, right? I don't actually meditate very much, but I could see that getting in a certain posture helps.
And that hand positioning is also how you see Tuvok in his quarters whenever he's meditating. He has that same hand position.
Okay, so I have another mind meld question about this. Is the position of the hands during a mind meld, is that purely to focus, or is there some kind of, is it have to do with the fact that they're touch telepaths? Does meditation work better when they put their hands together in some way?
Zachary, again, I am not a Vulcan master. I do not have the answers you seek.
Why, Suzanne? I want to know why. I want the reasons.
Because I am more Romulan than Vulcan. Accept it and move on.
See, I want to peek behind the curtain and see the wizard.
No.
So in this episode, of course, the children aren't actual children. They're old people that have reverse aged. That's what happens with their species, the Draenei. They age in reverse compared to humans.
So they're Benjamin Button.
Yes, this is Benjamin Button, proto-Benjamin Button, exactly. I think this is an interesting commentary on the nature of old age in general, right? Mm-hmm. Isn't this what happens when you get old, you get senile, you get Alzheimer's, you aren't as obsessed with the complexity of life because you've been there and you've done that, and you kind of get back to basics, focusing on the simpler things in life, becoming more childlike. I think this is just an interesting commentary on old age for us. We're pretty much like this. This is a metaphor for human aging.
Okay. Just say that.
I don't have a point. I just think it's an interesting observation.
Okay, yes, it is an interesting observation. I like how the kids only wanted to eat sweets, which is also true. The older you get, the more you just want your candies and cookies and all kinds of things like that. I have to get onto my mom about eating vegetables. And she's like, oh, I just had cookies for dinner last night. Mom, hello.
Cookies for dinner? That's awesome.
She did.
Is her name Tressa? Yeah.
No.
So let me ask you a question, because I think this is part of the point of the episode. The Draenei look forward to being in this state in old age, right? They look forward to shedding the cares of their worldly life, shedding the cares of their aging body, for lack of a better word, and focusing on returning to the simple things as they transition into moving their energy into a higher plane, however they described it in the episode. Is that the kind of thing that we humans should look forward to? Should we look forward to that senility in old age because it's a simpler way of life that helps us overcome the struggles and the complexity and the messiness of life, you know, in all the years leading up to that? Is that something to look forward to because it's simpler and more pure in some way? Or is that something to dread? I kind of dread it a little more. I can kind of see the appeal of having a simpler mindset when you're older, but I don't actually look forward to that.
Nobody should look forward to senility.
Well, with me, it's already happened. I'm halfway there.
That's true. You are. You're so old. I'm going to send you a cane.
I'm getting simpler by the year. Well, you see the appeal, right? You know, people look forward to retirement because they don't have to work anymore. They don't have to struggle, right? We don't even have to go so far as senility. Do we look forward to a pacifistic retirement, a peaceful retirement, you know, where you're done with the struggles of life?
Well, who wouldn't look forward to being done with, you know, getting up at the crack of dawn every day and working for somebody else and being told what to do?
There's like two kinds of people, right? There's the kinds of people that retire and then they're done. They've reached their goals and they've done their struggles and they've put their time in and they're done. They're gonna do whatever they do in retirement. And then there's the kind of person that's like, okay, I just retired. What's my next project? Right? They're never actually done. They never retire.
That would be my mom.
Just to bring it full circle.
Now she retired this past year and now she's volunteering at the dog pound. She works at this secondhand store, but she doesn't work. She volunteers her time there. It's like she can't stop. She has to keep moving.
I guess my point is there's an element of subjectivity to this. Like, some people are one and some people are the other. Which one are you, Suzanne? Are you going to have a project near retirement? Or are you going to put yourself out to pasture? Are you going to go in the cave and be raptured?
I'm going to be retiring to Mexico, where I will spend my days lounging on the beach or snorkeling.
We're going to be two old people on our desert island starting another podcast.
No, you can't follow me to Mexico, Zach. Get your own country.
Even if I stay on the other side of the island?
No.
What about this interesting discussion that happens in a couple of ways in the episode? We get a discussion between Tuvok and Tressa about whether death is something to fear. And Tuvok expresses his doubts about the Catra. He says, when I was younger, I used to have faith in the existence of the Catra and the immortality of the Catra. And now that I'm older, I have doubts. He says as much in the episode. And there's this parallel discussion with Alcea, the Draen woman who's aboard Voyager, about the nature of their true existence in a platonic sense as immaterial beings that are eternal and transcendent and whatnot. So again, death is nothing to fear because there's this immortality of the non-physical, non-embodied essence that they have. So, but ultimately the point is death is nothing to fear.
I don't think you're ever going to be able to convince people that, because it is the unknown. And we all, as Tuvok said, fear what we don't understand.
Well, there's this funny phrase, right? People, even people who want to go to heaven don't want to die to get there.
Huh? What? You said it was funny, so I gave you a pity laugh.
Not funny, ha-ha funny. Just kind of a, you know, it's clever, right? I mean, it's not ha-ha funny. Huh. It's not classically funny. Okay. I think I basically agree with you that, you know, even people who say they don't fear death probably don't mean it when death is staring them in the face. Mm-hmm. Some people, I guess, smile at their own deaths, right? I don't know.
I would say if they're going out on their own terms, possibly, depending on the situation.
Like, say you're in the shuttlecraft and the shuttlecraft is crashing. Tuvok basically says in the episode he's not even afraid of the shuttlecraft crashing. He's basically in a plane going down and he's not afraid.
Yeah, that would not be me. I would be screaming and trying to fix things and...
It is an interesting existential moment when you know for sure you're going to die and you can't do anything about it. And you know you've got 10 seconds or 15 seconds or 30 seconds left and that's it. And you know that's it. What an interesting existential moment that is.
Well, that sounds like the beginning of an Alanis Morissette song to me.
Isn't it ironic?
Yes, it is.
Walking down the street holding the peace sign.
That's a different song.
It's like rain on your wedding day.
That would be ironic, yes.
So do you believe Tuvok that he's not afraid when the shuttlecraft is going down?
I believe him because I don't think Tuvok is lying. I don't think he can lie.
He could be in denial.
Again, you're humanizing Tuvok. Stop.
I'm always doing that with Tuvok because I think Tuvok is one of the most emotional Vulcans there is.
More emotional than Spock, who was half human? Hello? No.
No, a pure Vulcan, right? Not... Tuvok is way more emotional than Sarek.
How often did we see Sarek?
Not very often, that's true. A little bit in TNG when he's starting to, suffer from Bandai syndrome, I think it was.
I think Tuvok is as emotional as T'Pol is, which is non-emotional.
Really? See, I read Tuvok as being very emotional, but barely able to hide it sometimes.
I don't see that.
Even when he's comforting Mr. Bennett, and even when he's being compassionate to these kids and teaching them to meditate and singing them a lullaby.
Because he didn't want to tell them about ferocious animals, which is what they asked him to talk about. He was only taking care of the children because there was no one else around to take care of them. He told Mr. Bennett what he told him because it was logical to tell him that. Tuvok was just doing the logical things in this episode.
So with Bennett, you don't think he's saying your girlfriend's going to miss you because that's something he knows he'll want to hear right before he dies?
No, because that wasn't even his girlfriend.
Or whoever she was, potential girlfriend, right? Whoever she was.
And I told you at the beginning why he told him that.
I know. I'm just driving this point home because I think these betray the fact that Tuvok is more emotional than he lets on.
No, you were just reading into it like you read into everything.
You're right. I do always look for subtext in the episodes. You're absolutely right.
You constantly look for it. And I think sometimes you make it up when it's not there.
Maybe. You're saying I read things into the episodes that aren't there regularly.
Yes. Just like I do with, you know, the Janeway Chakotay moments. I try and project what I want to see onto the screen.
I guess it's true that when we're commenting on an episode, that those comments reveal more about us than they do about the actual episode. That's true.
Yes.
Well, I, for one, don't look forward to being childlike in old age. I want to retain my full faculties, personally.
I don't look forward to death at all, ever.
Even if it's an interesting existential moment.
This isn't Metatrex.
No, not in any deep philosophical sense. I'm just talking about, is it an interesting moment? They don't look forward to it per se, but I think it's interesting, right? It's like, wow, here it is. Boom.
Like an interesting moment, like I'm murdered by some sort of clown? That kind of interesting or just...
No. It just, I guess, interesting because at any given moment, like most of human life or Draen life in this case, or Vulcan life, is a matter of uncertainty. You don't know when you're going to die. It could be tomorrow. It could be next year. It could be 40 years from now. You have no idea, right? But once in a while, people end up in a situation where they do know for sure. And that's a different situation than we live in the rest of our lives. I just think I've never been in that situation. Neither have you. I just think it's an interesting situation to be in.
So going along those lines, what about the Draen attendants that were with the children that died in the crash? They don't get to go to the cave and get raptured. What happens to their spirit?
Yeah, I think fundamentally, like, why is the cave a necessary part of the process, right? If you have this eternal essence that's non-physical that persists after you die, why do you need a cave? It doesn't make sense.
Other than to be really creepy and, you know, you disappear and your clothes are left behind. Left behind.
It's kind of like the aliens in that episode, Emanations. If you remember, they've got the little pods that transfer you to an asteroid, but they think you've ascended to a higher plane of existence. Except in that case, it makes sense. There's some technology at work, right? There's a machine that you go inside and it does something and poof, you're gone and you're transcended.
Yes.
The Draens aren't like that. They just have a cave. It's not a machine. It's not technology. But it's similar, right? You go into the cave just like these other people go into the pod. Mm-hmm. So the cave is part of their beliefs and their mythology and whatnot. But it's a little harder to see how the magic works in the case of the cave, whereas in Emanations, they've got a contraption that somehow does this.
Which is why I want to read Tuvok's log, because, you know he wrote it all down.
How does the magic work?
How does it work?
See, you want to peek behind the curtain, too.
But I don't want to know about mind melds and all that. I just want to know how their clothes magically are left behind. Is it like Thanos got rid of them or something, and they just sort of dust away?
Does some unfortunate Draen janitor have the job of going in and cleaning out the clothes periodically?
Or did they just collect over time?
An endlessly growing pile of left-behind clothes.
They would disintegrate after a while.
So there's this delicate balance of the number of people who are going into the cave, being transcended, shedding their clothes, and the decomposition rate of the clothes to maintain this delicate balance of clothing.
It could be a really big cave.
For all we know. Mm-hmm. But there's no monster in the cave. We settle that in the course of the episode.
That's on a different planet.
Well, it could have turned into something a bit like Heroes and Demons with an actual monster inside the cave, like Grendel, right? That would have been a different episode, but...
I was thinking more along the lines of Basics and poor Ensign Hogan. Oh, the worm thing out of the cave.
Well, all of this talk of death and old age and becoming childlike and innocent in old age is getting tedious. Let's talk about Chakotay,
yes.
One of your favorite topics.
Let's talk about Chakotay.
So I love Chakotay's story about propositioning the ambassador when he's trying to be diplomatic.
Well, of course, if anyone was going to mistakenly proposition an ambassador, it could only be Chakotay.
Chakotay wouldn't do it on purpose, is what you're saying.
It might have been on purpose, and he was just being sly about it. You never know.
Don't you know that's what that tribal greeting really is? Umna hu petsi nyets. Translates to, how you doing? Yeah, unbeknownst to Chakotay, that's actually a form of proposition in the Draen language, so it did the same thing all over again inside the transporter room. Well, clearly Chakotay's diplomatic skills have improved a little bit, right? Chakotay busts out the tribal greeting as a way of establishing a rapport with the visiting Draeans. And Janeway does the same thing, actually. She says, oh, your beliefs are like one of our greatest philosophers, Plato's. Right? They're being very diplomatic in this episode.
Well, of course, they're trying to get something.
You don't just become diplomatic for no reason, is that what you're saying? There's no altruism in diplomacy.
No, this entire time, Janeway's just trying to butter her up, which she pretty much comes out and says, we need this.
They don't actually want to become friends. They just need your whatever.
We just want to mine for some mineral type thing.
Got to replicate some more shuttlecrafts. Got to do some mining. Well, there's not much else with Chakotay, but Chakotay does get a couple of really great moments, right?
Yes,
talking about propositioning the ambassador. He gets to bust out the tribal greeting. They're good Chakotay moments, even though they're only a couple of moments in the grand scheme of things in this episode.
I'll take them.
You'll take all the Chakotay you can get.
Yes, I will.
Well, we know Chakotay does make you transcend to a higher plane of existence, Suzanne.
Ba-dow-bow.
Of course, this is not an episode of Metatrex, but I do find this platonic connection interesting, this idea that the Draeans' beliefs are similar to Plato's beliefs in the realm of the abstract, things that are non-physical ideal. I think it's even funny that the doctor gets cited as a potential platonic ideal for the Draeans, right? They go, wow, we believe in this non-corporeal essence that is more real than this, you know, earthly material existence. And the doctor must be like their savior, right? He's a non-material being. That's what they're trying to become. And the doctor is that. They could look up to the doctor as an ideal, right? They almost do that in the episode. Like, wow, you're what we're trying to attain.
I don't see that as being what they're trying to attain, because didn't they cast aside their technology?
Yeah, the Draeans have this technophobia, right? They've shed technology, mm-hmm. and they want to focus on the pure and the spiritual and the abstract and the non-material, and anything that is material is vulgar to them or undesirable in some way. So the doctor is an interesting conundrum, because he's fundamentally non-material. He's photons and force fields. So in that sense, he appeals to their platonic nature, but he's also a piece of technology. So they must have this dual gut reaction to the doctor. And they're a little xenophobic too, right? They just want to keep to themselves. They don't like outsiders.
Yep.
Well, this is a pretty common Star Trek stereotype, right? This is like one of the types of Star Trek aliens out there. You've got
the xenophobia. Yes.
You've got the warlike aliens. You've got Klingons and Kazon, but you also have the xenophobic aliens. That's a type of alien in Star Trek. So this is a straight up stereotypical xenophobic alien race.
Go ahead, say it. Romulans. Go ahead, say it. I know you want to.
Romulan xenophobic? Well, no, you have the imperialistic aliens, right? Mm-hmm. So that's not xenophobia, right? The Romulans are imperialistic. I wouldn't call them xenophobic.
They're not allowed contact with outside races. That's xenophobic.
Maybe more so in the original series, when we first meet the Romulans, they stick to themselves and they don't.
Think about Eye of the Needle.
Oh, yeah. They're very hesitant to interact. Mm-hmm. But that's mainly political, right?
Who knows? It's been fun talking about attaining a meditative state today, but that isn't the only thing we've been discussing on the network. So here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Meta Treks.
You can see the Gene Roddenberry playing with the idea of what we could become given our full potential, and the aliens that have achieved that looking down and kind of criticizing or examining or evaluating humanity from a moral standpoint, almost like Q does in putting humanity on trial. There's a sense in which humanity is being judged by these morally superior aliens that are genuinely pacifists.
Or in the case of Q, genuinely narcissistic.
Warp 5.
There's 89 Suliban plus Archer and Mayweather, and now Reed, and nobody notices this an extra body because they don't have jumpsuits, so he doesn't have a number or anything.
And probably all Suliban look alike to them.
Of course they do. Mm-hmm. That's what we're getting at here, right? They're all identical. I guess there's a boy version and a girl version, and that's it.
Literary Treks.
Well, you know, when I was watching the show, the thing I saw when I was reading people's commentary about the show and, you know, what people's impressions of his character were, I was seeing a lot of people who suffered like kind of social anxiety and kind of like, you know, issues about their sort of like their sense of self. And they were saying that they identified really strongly with the idea that Saru is this guy who's kind of like, you know, he's being pulled in two different directions. You know, he has a very strong ego, but he wants to be liked. You know, he wants to be an outgoing character, but he's also quite introverted. And there were a lot of people who had that experience in their lives saying, this character really speaks to me because I see a lot of myself in them.
The 602 Club.
One of the things that really caught me in the movie was this whole idea of the family dynamics that we get. And I was fascinated with this because a lot of Spielberg's early movies are about families. But in many ways, through the lens of like divorce or possible divorce. And Deneuve said that in the interview for the extras, the director of Arrival and Blade Runner 2049. He was talking about how that really struck a chord with him because one of the biggest fears for kids' life in the 70s was, you know, parents splitting up and divorce was on the rise. And so one of the scariest things that could happen to you would be to have your parents split up.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out all these shows and join in the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on iPhone, iPad, or Apple TV, or the desktop iTunes app to get the latest episodes as soon as they're published. And please leave us a star rating and written review. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, in most third-party apps, and you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website or grab the RSS link.
Well, we would love to hear your thoughts on today's episode of To the Journey, and there are lots of ways for you to share your thoughts with us. The best place to join in the larger conversation with us is the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it should come right up. If you'd like to send us an email, you can use the form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Just choose Message to a Trek FM Show and select To the Journey. That will come right to us. You can also find the network on Twitter at Trek FM and on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. Well, Suzanne, speaking of contact information, when you're not exchanging tribal greetings with Chakotay, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
Is that all I get to exchange with Chakotay?
Anything you like, Suzanne.
Woohoo! You can find me popping up in the Babel Conference, and you can also find me on Twitter. My handle is KJaneWay8. So, Zachary, when you're not forcing dying aliens to mind meld with you, where can our listeners find you on Trek FM and around the interwebs?
Well, you can find me elsewhere on Trek.fm as co-host of MetaTrek's Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. You can also find me in the Babel Conference if you'd like to talk about Voyager with me in there. And you're welcome to follow me on Twitter. My handle is just my name, at Zachary Fruhling. That's Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, Fruhling, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G.
If you'd like to help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week, you can become a patron of the network on Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm to get all the details. Perks include early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and more. All available through our special patrons website, The Patron Zone. It requires a great deal of money to produce, host, and distribute these shows each month. We really appreciate any support you give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm.
We'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the To the Journey team from around the network. Specifically, we'd like to thank C. Brian Jones, the founder and publisher of Trek.fm, who also moonlights as the Morok, interestingly enough. Our executive producers, Matthew Rushing and Kenneth Tripp, Aaron Harvey, our art director, Richard Marquez, our production manager, and Brandon Shea Mutala, our Patreon manager. And a special thank you and a shout out to our five associate producers here on To the Journey. We'd like to thank Bruce Lish, Ju Kim, Richard Marquez, Patrick Carlin, and Norman Lau. Thank you very much for your support of To the Journey and Trek FM.
Well, join us next time where we will be doing experiments on various articles of clothing to see how quickly they will disintegrate after the rapture. But until then, this has been To the Journey.